How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is The Guardian.
Cloud capital affords those who own it exorbitant power. And who has cloud capital today? The United States and China. China is the only country in the world that has an equivalent, a competitor to Google, to Amazon, to Facebook, to all of them. And on top of that, they've got something that Americans don't have. So the question for Australians is this: do you really want to get embroiled in a war between the United States and China over whose cloud capital is going to dominate?
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Guardian Australia's Chief Political Correspondent, coming to you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. Today on Australian Politics, my guest is Yannis Varoufakis, the economist and former Greek finance minister, who joins us after an appearance at the National Press Club on Wednesday, where he said that a new Cold War is unfolding between the US and China and their respective arsenals of tech firms. We talked about Varoufakis' new book, Techno-Feudalism, in which he argues capitalism is already dead and its replacement is influencing everything from how we are manipulated as consumers to Australia's role between China and the US. Welcome, Yanni. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start first with your book, Techno-Feudalism. Could you explain to the listeners who may not have seen you at the Press Club or the Australia Institute, what is techno-feudalism and what is cloud capital?
Cloud capital is the latest mutation of capital. Capital has existed well before capitalism. A fishing rod is a capital good in the sense that it has been produced, not for its own sake, but to help you catch fish. A tractor is produced to help you not go around town on it, but to cultivate the land to produce wheat or corn or whatever. Cloud capital is a form of capital that has never existed before. It is capital, machinery again, it lives in our phones, in our laptops, on the internet. It belongs to big tech. And what it does, it's an automated mechanism, an algorithm, a piece of machinery, network machinery, that modifies our behavior. So we train it to train it put desires into our heads after it understands us perfectly well, as these machines really do understand us perfectly well, after monitoring us and after training us to train them to know us. Once it knows us so well, and after having given us very good advice about books to read, music to listen to, then when it suggests an electric bike, we buy it because we have had all this experience of having received good advice from it. And that is remarkable because it's more than advertising. Because advertisers of yesteryear, even if they convinced you to buy something, you had to go to the shops to buy it. But this piece of cloud capital, this piece of capital, not only tells me what I want, but also sells it to me directly, bypassing every market. When you buy something out of Amazon, Amazon.com is not the market. And at the same time, it makes me, to volunteer, and you and all of us, our free labor to replenish that cloud capital every time we post a review of a product on Amazon.com. We like something or dislike it. Every time we tweet, every time we upload a video on Facebook or a piece of text or a photograph on Instagram, we are replenishing that cloud capital with our free labor. That has never happened before. This is no longer capitalism. It is techno-feudalism.
Now, I want to challenge this view about users of technology becoming cloud serfs, as you call them, who are exploited by giving unpaid labour through apps. And I'll give three quick examples. On a driving holiday in a regional area, I urgently needed my car serviced, so I dropped in at a mechanic despite there being no Google reviews for this mechanic. I found the service to be excellent, quick and cheap, so I left a Google review, helping future consumers and also helping that auto shop compete against other auto shops. On Spotify Premium, that helps me find new music and, you know, that increases my enjoyment and my usage, even though I only pay a flat fee, no matter how many songs I listen to. If I book an Uber to go to the airport, the app drives a very hard bargain as far as the driver is concerned, and I understand the possible element of exploitation there. But for the consumer, it's cheaper than the taxi industry. It's so successfully disrupted. So am I a cloud surf? Where's the scam in these examples?
Nothing of what you said contradicts or challenges my thesis. It actually adds to it. This is the beauty of cloud capital. Everything it does for us is stuff that we enjoy. It's voluntary labor. Nobody forces us to upload reviews on car mechanics or books. By the way, I use them all the time. I'm not arguing against using them. But what I'm saying is this. Exactly, precisely because of what you're saying, they have so much power over us. Once they've lured us in with good advice, with service, cheap service and so on, we are the cloud surfs. Because with your review for the mechanic, you think that you help the mechanic. Yes, you help the mechanic, but primarily you helped Google increase the stock of its cloud capital. And make no mistake that Google is going to penalize that mechanic in the same way it penalizes the Uber driver. But this is not the moral point, you see. I don't want our listeners to make the mistake of thinking that I'm here a moralist saying, oh, yeah, these are bad people because they exploit. No, what I'm saying is this. When the value that is created by the driver, by the producer of electric bicycles who sells on Amazon, by the musicians who sell their music on Spotify, by the way, I use Spotify all the time, and like you, I've learned a lot of beautiful music. I've come across beautiful music because of Spotify, and I owe Spotify a debt of gratitude. But nevertheless, if you're a musician, you can't make a living. Mm. So there's all this value which is created by mechanics, musicians, taxi drivers, workers in Amazon's warehouses and so on. And that is skimmed by the 0.001% of the population. Again, this is not a moralistic argument. My argument is this. When about 40% of GDP, this is where we're at now in the West, 40% and China, 40% of GDP is skimmed off by the owners of this cloud capital, that money disappears from the circular flow of income. So it doesn't come back to you. Yeah? If it went to somebody who actually, to the garage mechanic, to the taxi driver, it would come back to you because they would spend it in the shops, theater, whatever. Jeff Bezos is not spending it because he can't spend it. If you have 250 billion and I give you another billion, even if you want to spend it, you can't. There's just not enough hours in the day. So that money is withdrawn from the circular flow of income. That means demand is low, investment is low because no capitalist is going to invest when the level of demand is low. The quality of jobs is really, am I allowed to say on your podcast, crap?
Oh, yes, far away.
BS jobs. and the result is that, then the Reserve Bank of Australia needs to pump more money into the economy to refloat it. That creates inflation. You pay through the nose higher prices. So the functioning of cloud capital, because it is owned by the 0.0001%, it is detrimental to the collective welfare, to the common good. That's my point. And therefore, it creates crises which make our societies poorer and poorer in the long run. Even though we have cheaper and cheaper stuff, we get cheapened and our life becomes increasingly diminished.
And is that true even where social media is a platform for citizen journalism or for political organizing? Do you still take the view that it's disempowering to users to be giving that content away and to have more and more of their time and attention sucked up by it?
Not in the slightest. I'm all in favor of algorithms. Algorithms are a testimony to the brilliance of the human spirit. The fact that we've created algorithms, AI programs, that can design antibiotics, that can kill bacteria that human researchers have not managed to provide antibiotics to kill them. That's fantastic. We need more of that. If a cooperative of taxi drivers were to use to come up with an algorithm similar to Uber and own it in order to take us around in a manner which does not exploit them, as Uber does, and doesn't exploit us because Uber sells our data. You know, every time you catch an Uber, Uber knows where you went, what mood you were in while you were going, because it knows what music you were listening to through Spotify. It cross-tabulates the probabilities that, 2 hours after you went to where you went, you bought something and that it sells to Amazon. So compare and contrast this private ownership of cloud capital, which diminishes our lives and exploits all of us in a way which is detrimental to the interests of society, with a cooperative where they own their own algorithm. You know, imagine like you, your good self, you know, a cooperative of journalists that uses an algorithm in order to tell me of the great journalistic work you do. That's fantastic. That's brilliant. It's a question not of the machinery, not of the algorithm. It's a question of who owns it.
So on the view that it's not the technology, it's who owns it, would a government-issued digital identity and bank account and currency, would that really be sufficient for cooperatives to spring up like you've described, competing with Uber? If I'm standing on a street corner with my government digital identity and bank account, would Uber not still have a natural advantage in a bigger network that would outcompete anything springing up like that?
To answer your question directly, no, it wouldn't be sufficient, but it would be necessary.
Okay.
First step. A necessary first step.
Yeah.
But that's important, you know. You set the foundation and then you go from having provided what is necessary to providing what is quasi-sufficient. It is important to make all those changes and slowly but steadily deplete the exorbitant power that the highly concentrated ownership of those algorithms have. And how can you do this? Well, imagine that we were to say, since the capital of Uber, of Amazon, is replenished by you and me, by all of us, we through free labor. It could be, it's definitely voluntary. I'm not saying that we are forced to do it, but it's voluntary labor, which is free, gives them capital, and they don't pay us dividends. So imagine if we were to say here in Australia or in Britain, or even better if it was in Britain and Australia and the European Union and the United States simultaneously, you want to operate in our jurisdiction, okay? 10% of your shares will have to go to a social equity fund, a sovereign fund, and dividends accumulate, and then we distribute them equally as a basic income to the citizens of this country. Now that would go a long way towards sufficiency.
Mm. The regulation of the internet has come a long way. The EU has its general data protection regulation.
Yeah, but that is a complete cop-out and a disaster.
So you think governments have been far too soft on the tech companies so far by the sounds of it?
Look, I don't want to be harsh on governments. They've been far too clueless. Absolutely clueless. They thought that by introducing more bureaucracy, they would somehow impede the application and exercise of exorbitant power. It doesn't. It doesn't really. If you really want to hurt the extravagant power of those cloudalists, as I call them, the owners of this cloud capital, you can do things, but you have to be smart about it. For instance, you can introduce interoperability. So, take Twitter. Lots of people can't stand Elon Musk ever since he bought it, but you can't escape Twitter. If you're in it and you've got a few thousand followers or millions of followers, like I do, right? How do you leave? You can leave. You can go to another platform which is empty of people, and then you talk to yourself. But imagine if you could take your followers with you, or imagine if you could force Twitter, if you go to Blue Sky or another such messaging or opinion-expressing application. Imagine if you were to force Twitter to communicate from Blue Sky to your Twitter followers everything you say on Blue Sky. And that would be the equivalent of what actually happened 20 years ago, 15 years ago, with mobile telephones. Because once upon a time, you know, Telstra would give you a mobile number. And then if you wanted to go to Optus because it offered a better deal, you had to take another number. And then the government stepped in and said, no, you can carry interoperability. You can carry your number. So there are things that can be done, but you need politicians who are firstly clued, they know what's going on, and secondly, capable of overcoming cowardice.
And are things like Australia's news media bargaining code, are those sort of nibbling around the edges in terms of getting revenue from the tech companies?
Look, I'm not a maximalist. I think that that was a good thing that happened. And I salute that. But at the same time, I get depressed when I think of why it happened. And the reason why it happened was not because politicians overcame cowardice. It's because Rupert Murdoch got peeved with the Facebooks and the TikToks and so on and stepped in and forced the two major parties to do their job. Now, if we have to rely on Rupert Murdoch for the government to do what is right, then we are in a very sad state.
In your press club speech on Wednesday, you talked about Australia's growing irrelevance because we don't own a significant amount of cloud capital. We do have some advantages. We've got, you know, big savings in superannuation. We've got good conditions for solar and wind. We have natural advantage in critical minerals, important for a green energy transition. So what should we be doing to remain relevant?
You can't blame Australia for not being able to come up with concentrations of cloud capital to compete with the Americans and the Chinese. Europe hasn't managed it. Why would Australia do it on its own? But you're quite right. There are things Australia can do, like, for instance, create commonly owned public cloud capital in the form of a digital payment system that the Reserve Bank of Australia provides to everybody. That you could do tomorrow morning if you were prepared to clash with the bankers. But you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned energy, green energy, and what Australia should do in order to participate in the new technological era in an efficient and smart way. And here is the proposal that I put forward at the National Press Club in a more succinct form. Europe is going to introduce in the next few months a tax on the border. So any Chinese car, electric car, that goes into Europe that contains in its batteries nickel or cobalt or lithium that is produced in environment-destructive ways, in brown ways, is going to be taxed on the border. Now, Australia has huge areas of arid land, which you could cover tomorrow morning with solar panels, wall-to-wall solar panels, producing electricity, which produces green hydrogen. And then you use that green hydrogen in new plants to refine your metals, your copper from South Australia, your cobalt, your nickel, your iron. You refine it into green cobalt. So you export that to the Chinese or to the Koreans or to whoever, and they will produce the cars, but they will be green. And that is a way in which you can participate in the production of electric vehicles, the new green technologies, using energy, delinking yourself from brown, unrefined products, including fossil fuels, and participate in the international green division of labor.
You talk about that this shift to techno-feudalism, that it has intensified a new Cold War with China. To take the example of Australia signing up to the AUKUS alliance with the US and UK to gain nuclear submarines, ostensibly that's about deterring an invasion of Taiwan and about deterring an interruption of global trade. That looks like geostrategic competition in the physical world, not the digital one. So what makes you say that cloud capital is a dominant driver of that competition?
Before we get to AUKUS and those submarines, the question is, why is there a new Cold War? Until 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the United States was bending over backwards to induct China into the World Trade Organization, into the capitalist order of things. It was exporting to China its production lines, its iPhone production facilities and so on. What went wrong? When I ask this question, people tell me, oh, Taiwan. I don't believe this because the Chinese government's view on Taiwan has been the same, exactly the same, ever since Nixon went to China, one China policy. And that was the policy of the United States as well. So what has changed there? China is not more aggressive toward Taiwan than it was 30 years ago. So I don't buy that. I really don't buy that.
Arguably it is. Arguably it's a long-term objective to retake the territory.
Yes, exactly. But that was the case 15 years ago when the United States was telling your government to go into bed with China. So why are they now telling you to buy nuclear submarines against China? That is a question that goes unanswered so far. The second explanation is because China is building up its military strength and it is escalating the new Cold War. That's, of course, absolutely indefensible. Because if you look at the relative strength of the United States and China, the fact that they are building up some of their capacity to defend their own shores, when there are, as Malcolm Fraser said once before he died, when there are Chinese Navy vessels outside the coast of California threatening with their presence, like the American Navy ships are outside Shenzhen and Shanghai as we speak. When that happens, then I will accept that there is escalation by China. There is no such thing. They are defending their coasts. America will never accept Russian, British, French ships anchoring outside Norfolk, Virginia, where the U.S. Navy base is. Okay, so I don't buy that either. So this was a question I had. I tried to, in writing this book, part of that was to try to understand why is this new Cold War? And increasingly, I came to the hypothesis, to the conclusion, I may be wrong, but that's my understanding of why there is a new Cold War, that the reason is because cloud capital affords those who own it exorbitant power. And who has cloud capital today? The United States and China. China is the only country in the world that has an equivalent, a competitor to Google, to Amazon, to Facebook, to all of them. And on top of that, they've got something that the Americans don't have. A seamlessly integrated big tech, all these digital services, with payments. Now, the Americans don't have it, not because they're not technologically advanced, but because Wall Street won't allow that. Because Wall Street does not want to share its financial gains with Apple and with Facebook. Remember when Facebook tried to introduce a digital currency, it was knocked down by Wall Street. So that is a disadvantage the United States have. And remember, the United States is hegemonic around the world, even though it is in the red. It is constantly in a big trade deficit to the world. How do they manage to pay for this? Because they have the monopoly of international payments. The big cloud capital, which is seamlessly integrated with financial capital in China, is a clear and present danger to the hegemony of the United States. So the question for Australians is this. Do you really want to get embroiled in a war between the United States and China over whose cloud capital is going to dominate? Because this is what is happening. And by the way, those submarines are a ludicrous, ludicrous deal. It is ridiculous to spend $368 billion on submarines that the company or the country that sells them to you can switch off at the touch of a button. You know that, of course, if you are driving a Tesla, Elon Musk can switch it off remotely. Why do you want to buy a submarine that the person you're going to buy it from, if you buy it from them, because they're not even capable of building them now, it will take 10, 15 years, right? Then they can switch it off.
I think that might be true of Teslas. I'm not sure that is true of the nuclear submarines.
Well, be sure. Be sure, but do not underestimate the intelligence of the Americans. Do you think they will ever sell you a submarine and not have the remote control? They may not admit it, but of course they will have the remote. I would do it. You would do it. If you were to sell a lethal weapon to a country that you consider to be your lackey, you keep the remote control switched on.
I think the lack of sovereign control might relate more to training and to requiring them for the nuclear power.
Do you really believe that the British submarines that Britain has and they've bought after Triton died, after they had no longer a capacity to produce their own nuclear, do you believe that the British can actually fire a nuclear weapon without the okay of the United States that sold them that? No way.
I take the point as far as Tesla is concerned, that is concerning that those are centrally.
You see that is the crime against logic of the previous government, because the French submarines were perfectly capable of defending Australia's coasts, and because they were low tech, they would be completely under the sovereign control of this country. And it was a major error of the ALP slavishly to side with the coalition government's idiotic decision.
The next question is from our Victorian correspondent, Benita Kolovos, who asks, what do you think the future of the two-party system is in Australia? Will there be a splintering like we see in Greece? And will the left or centre-left party ever win outright in Greece again?
Well, starting with Australia, you've got the preferential system of voting in combination with single-member constituencies, which is the equivalent of first-past-the-post. In other words, there is no room for a third party in the House of Reps in this country, in the same way that in Britain or in the United States, there is no room for a third party. Even if there is one, it will be decimated because of the electoral system, which means that the two-party system will survive. What will happen, however, is that the already very low quality of Australia's democracy as a result of two parties trying to emulate one another and simply disagreeing on marginal issues means that apathy will grow. And apathy is the poison of democracy. As for Greece, look, this is a question that depresses me no end, because at the moment we have a hugely dominant government which is in the service of a tiny minority of oligarchs. With the rest of us, and I include myself in that, in the opposition, finding it impossible to mount a quasi-united opposition to them, allowing, therefore, the oligarchy to rule the country in a way that renders my country socially and economically unviable.
I want to ask about quantitative easing. You argue that cheap money is to blame for accelerating the financialization of the economy and being the source of cloud capital. What should have happened after the global financial crisis instead, and how can we unwind this now?
In 2008, 2009, sometime in April 2009 to be precise, the leaders, the great and good leaders of the G7, along with their central bankers, met in London. And they decided to print as much money as it was necessary to refloat the financial sector. So that flooded banks and the financial sector with money, state money. That was a huge mistake, because at the same time, the practice of austerity on the people, they cut expenditure on public services, on pensions, on wages, for that matter. And the result was that the many were impecunious. Big business had access to huge amounts of money, but they looked at outside the window and they saw little people with no money due to the austerity. So they didn't invest. Why would you invest in goods and high-end products when the population out there that don't have enough money to buy it? So they took the money that the central banks had printed and they took it to the stock exchange where they bought back their own shares. That's not an investment. The share prices went up. They got huge bonuses because their bonuses are linked to the share price. Okay, so that created huge inequality and that perpetuated the stagnation. Imagine if, I'm not against printing money. Money is printed all the time. I'm not against that. The question is, what do you do with it? So imagine you had a public investment bank. I mean, we do have one in Europe called the European Investment Bank. The British used to have it once, so they could have it again. So imagine you have a public investment bank that issues its own bonds, in other words, borrows in the markets, and the central bank comes up with one small little announcement, press release, saying, I will support these bonds if needs be. I will buy them if their price starts going down or the interest rate goes up. But just saying that, they wouldn't have to buy them because everybody who had money would buy them, knowing that the price would not go down because the central bank would help. And then you had a fund that you can spend on investing in green, good quality jobs and energy and all the things that we never invested in over the last 15 years. That's why we still are reliant on dirty fossil fuels that are destroying the planet. That would have created good quality jobs. It would have created genuine development, genuine decoupling from brown technologies. That is a mistake.
Last question. I wanted to ask, as a former finance minister of Greece, if you have tips for Treasurer Jim Chalmers and Finance Minister Katie Gallagher as they put together Australia's next federal budget.
You need a massive public investment fund. Not having it a massive, when I say massive, I mean 5 to 10% of GDP needs to be invested in solar power, which will create the new infrastructure for refining metals into green metals, because that will be the future of Australia. To think that that would be fiscally responsible is fiscally responsible.
I might follow up on that about fiscal irresponsibility. For a while, the world seemed to be having a moment with modern monetary theory where, you know, people were appreciating that treasurers should be more concerned about growing the real productive capacity of the economy rather than whether a budget is in surplus or deficit. At the moment, there's very high global inflation, which doesn't disprove modern monetary theory, but it does seem to make it less fashionable. Are we taking the wrong lessons from the current period of high inflation?
As an economist, I dislike the mention of theories, especially when we're talking to people out there who should be the decision makers and the experts, because, you know, we economists always have a tendency to phrase things that everybody understands in a language that no one comprehends. So let's be clear on this. We had a fantastic opportunity after the GFC, since we printed all this money, to direct it into the things society needs to create good quality green jobs and save the planet and society. We wasted it on the basis that it will create inflation. It didn't create inflation. We printed mountains of money, $35 trillion American dollars we printed. There was no inflation. And because we didn't invest it, our capacity to produce was very limited by the time the pandemic hit. So the pandemic hits, it disrupts supply chains, because of the lockdown. And even when we got out of the lockdown, our capacity to produce was very little because for 15 years we were not investing in anything. And of course then the prices started going up. It's got nothing to do with money printing. It's the way we wasted the printed money that explains the inflation. And now that, you know, you have treasuries all over the world and central bankers who feel that they are damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Well, sorry for using the T word. You're a much better evangelist for a Green New Deal than I am. So thank you for putting that so eloquently, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
If you liked this interview with Yanis Varoufakis, you can hear more of his analysis in a special new podcast series about generational inequality. It's called Who Screwed Millennials? This will be aired in the Full Story podcast feed very soon. Here's a little preview.
I'm Jane Lee.
And I'm Matilda Bosley.
We live in a time where, for most millennials, our economic futures are less about how hard we work and more about how wealthy our parents are.
Millennials are a generation that is living through a series of broken promises.
As a millennial, how do you feel about the economic future of this generation?
It certainly doesn't look great.
But because conversations about this generational divide often focus on the here and now, how terrible things are right now, it's easy to lose sight of how we got here.
We're seeing a real shift in how we talk about economic instability and whose fault it is.
So in this special Full Story series from Guardian Australia, we're figuring out who screwed millennials.
You really could not think of a better combination of two tax policies that are going to set fire to a housing market.
We're figuring out how something that had nothing to do with housing screwed millennials out of the Australian dream.
What do Australians invest in? They invest in property. And so suddenly we had a huge tax boon for people who invested in property.
We're investigating how good debt turned bad.
It wasn't the original idea that was wrong.
And screwed millennials out of an affordable education.
The fact that HECS has and can be politicised, depending on who's in government, creates certain problems.
They started out saying, no, no, we're not going to deregulate university fees. There'll never be an American-style higher education system. There won't be any $100,000 university fees under this government. And then they did pretty much all of that.
And looking back, trying to find where and when our work became so insecure.
emotionally, I was really bad. Sometimes I talk to my husband like, I think I'm a slave here in Australia. I'm working and have no life.
Brands began chasing bigger profit margins for themselves. And it was not really a bargaining process because the brand had all the power.
More and more workers are left to bargain one-on-one against their boss rather than to have a union to do that for them. And as a result, people get paid a lot less.
Find out who screwed millennials by subscribing to Full Story wherever you get your podcasts.
The series will be in your feeds from March 25th.
This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni. I'm Paul Karp. Thanks for listening.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. 6 factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.